the House Committee on Health Care to order for this happy day after Oregon's birthday, February 15th, and make a couple comments first. I do not intend to reopen for another public hearing, House Bill 2133. Representative Thompson's not here yet, is he? We have an amendment or more coming on that, and the real issue that we're dealing with in this is the role of the role of the citizens advisory committees in the CCOs. We think we'll be putting together a work group on that issue to look at the broader question. This bill is one way of looking at the role. Incidentally, just for the record, we checked on when the recertification of CCOs come, and it comes after 6 years. So if we pass this bill, there'll be plenty of time to figure out how to implement it by the CCOs. But our interest, rather, in Representative Thompson and I and Representative Kenny Geyer really believe we need a serious discussion of the role of the citizens involved in CCOs, and we're going to put together a work group to see that that happens. So we will not be opening up a public hearing. The next time we'll see it, if we see it again in this session, it will be for a work session. But we are going to put together a work group, and I think Representative Thompson is going to lead that work group, although he's not here right now, but I think that's the plan. But what I would like to do now is open up an informational meeting and ask Fisher Tillman to join us to give us some background for the discussion of the two bills that will follow.
Okay, well, good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Kenny Geyer and committee. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the Director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion at the Oregon Health Authority. And I want to thank you for the opportunity and the impossible task that you've given me, Chair Greenlick, of presenting to you in 15 minutes the key points related to health equity, to inform you as you begin your deliberations today, but also hopefully to inspire you to continue to advance health equity throughout this legislative session and beyond. I have prepared probably more than 15 minutes worth of information, but what I don't get to, you'll have in your PowerPoints. I think you have them in front of you. And I'm happy to meet with you again as a committee or individually to dialogue further about any part of this presentation. So as I start, let's start by thinking about how we define health. When you think about your own personal health, do you think about it as merely the absence of disease or infirmity, or do you think about it as a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being?
I got news for you. In my age, the absence of infirmity is pretty good.
Good. That you're here is a state of well-being.
It changes with time.
Actually, I was in Cornelius this morning at Virginia Garcia Clinic, a meeting with a number of Latino families who have children with disabilities, and we started by asking them, what do they think about health, and how do they define the concept of health? And they were very clear that they defined it in terms of physical and mental health, which was good, but also in terms of spiritual health and intellectual health and understanding what kind of health information they needed to know to help their children succeed. So that was really encouraging. So these are some of the factors that promote physical, mental, and social well-being, and we can think about how these all show up in our lives. Again, the families in Cornelius, they really love the feeling of connectedness in their small town. And they also experience serious barriers to healthcare and to health in terms of being able to access parks for their children who had physical mobility challenges, and also to swimming pools where they wanted to be able to take their kids so that they could get exercise. So health equity, how do we talk about that in the context of a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being? And as you look around this room today, it may be easy for you to imagine that some of the people sharing the space with you today have experienced challenges gaining access to the factors that promote physical, mental, and social well-being. They may have experienced barriers beyond their personal control to influence. They may have experienced war trauma, been separated from their families and communities in order to find work or safety. They may have experienced situations that undermine their sense of human dignity or their ability to live in healthy homes. They may have inherited traumas that were experienced by their ancestors and live each day without being able to speak their native language or even the knowledge of what country their families originate from. So in order to achieve health equity, we need to not only address specific health behaviors and meet people's individual health needs at the doctor's office or the clinic, but we have to also address societal obstacles that prevent individuals from achieving the highest level of health. And achieving that highest possible level of health for everybody requires tailored strategies and specific efforts to improve health of people who have experienced disadvantage, whether social or economic. So that takes continuous effort. It means that the strategies that we put in place for the families in Cornelius might not look the same as for refugees coming in from Southern Asia or from Africa. So we have to think about how those strategies might look different. So health inequities are not about individual behaviors, though undoing them does require individual behavior change at every level of society. It requires individuals to make healthy choices in their daily lives, but it also requires that healthcare providers, policymakers like yourselves, city planners, housing developers, and others to make choices in our daily work that promote health. So as an example, the families in Cornelius talked about how the city planner now comes to them when they're planning a new park to make sure that the facilities will be accessible to their children. Health inequities are the evidence of systemic unfairness over generations. And none of us probably created health inequities ourselves, but as leaders, we are needed, all of our efforts are needed to bend the curve back towards equity. And we can't do nothing or do everything the same way we've done it and expect to change. So what are the causes of health inequities? We categorize them in terms of barriers to healthcare access, differences in quality of healthcare, and the social determinants of health. And it was really interesting to see how this played out this morning in this conversation. The families that were there today talked about how they had to wait weeks or months to get access to health care for their children. These were children with special health care needs, having to wait years to get reevaluations done for their children to determine whether they have autism or attention deficit. And all of this impacted their family stress as well as their children's ability to perform in school. In terms of differences in quality of health care, the families shared that they were had been told by several providers that if they couldn't lift their children up onto the exam table, that the providers wouldn't see them. And when they're talking about their children, they're talking about 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds, you know, hefty children that parents, you know, I couldn't imagine lifting my child up onto an exam table. And then the social determinants of health are the social conditions in which people live that lead to differences in health outcomes. So a patient might, in my neighborhood, might with diabetes, might leave a clinic with directions to decrease salt and fat intake in their diet, but before they get home from the clinic, pass the McDonald's, the Kentucky Fried Chicken, the Popeyes, the Burger King, and the Wendy's before they're able to get home. And if they're working two jobs and have kids who are hungry, it's real easy to pull into the drive-through. So what are the causes of health inequities?
Too many people.
So we expect to see differences in health outcomes when we're comparing an individual with a diagnosis with an individual without a diagnosis. A person with diabetes is more likely to have eye disease than somebody without diabetes. And a person who is frail and elderly is more likely to experience devastating falls than someone who is young. So some of the disparities or differences, while important and while they require targeted interventions, are not as avoidable due to physical, physiological, or psychological conditions. However, some differences are unjust and avoidable. Differences in access to quality of care, such as differential treatment, experience of discrimination, and lack of cultural competency, are often more related to the perceptions of the provider rather than on the individual's actual insurance status, ability to pay, or diagnosis. And those perceptions are often rooted in personal and institutional bias. Throughout most of our history, both as a state and as a country, racism, discrimination, and the resulting lack of political and economic power of communities of color, immigrants, and refugees were explicit in policies and practices. And while many became illegal with the Civil Rights Act or the Americans with Disabilities Act, full understanding or commitment or compliance with these laws has been slow. So I want to share just a couple examples of how social determinants play out in terms of health equity in Oregon. So in 1954, Western Oregon Indian tribes were terminated, which abolished tribal governments, ended federal services, and sold off tribal lands at a fraction of their value, and was intended to disrupt family stability, economic stability, education, and health, with the explicit purpose of assimilating American Indians into the dominant culture. And in terms of how this connects to health, diabetes, which was virtually non-existent prior to this, now is one of the more prevalent health conditions among American Indians. So there's also more current illustrations of this. A 2008 Oregonian study showed that Black and Latino borrowers in Oregon were twice as likely to get a subprime loan as whites of the same income level, even after controlling for income or credit score. So these consequences of predatory loans are now experienced by many Oregonians, but have been particularly impactful in the African American community. We know that home ownership and housing stability is a health protective factor. So there are many ways to look at health inequities. We can understand them by focusing on the singular factor, either by diagnosis. We know that people with mental illness have a shorter life expectancy than people without a mental illness. We can look by population or by geography or by risk factor. But where we look as an office is where these factors intersect. And oftentimes, as institutions, we don't look at that level of intersectionality. So for example, the families in Cornelius experienced language barriers, cultural barriers, also dealing with children with a disability, living in a rural community. All of those factors contribute to health inequities. And when we just focus in on healthcare, we see the same pattern. So the Institute of Medicine published a report in 2003, and they found significant variations in the rates of medical procedures by race, and this was even after controlling, again, for insurance status, income, age, and severity of the condition. And they found that U.S. racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to receive even routine medical procedures and experience lower quality of health services. Minorities are less likely to be given appropriate cardiac medications or to undergo bypass surgery, and are less likely to receive kidney dialysis or transplants. And then minorities are more likely to receive certain less desirable procedures, such as lower limb amputations or other treatment. So why is health equity a priority? Here, of course, we're acutely aware that we are expected through Oregon's health systems transformation to produce a 2% reduction in health care costs. But in a national study that was released in September 2009...
Can I comment on that? We're talking about a 2 percentage point reduction in the increase in costs?
Yes.
I'm not talking about a reduction in costs.
Sorry about that.
And it's not 2%. It's a 40% decrease in the increase in costs.
It's decreased 5.4% to 3.4%.
Right. In the increase, right. So bending the curve. But the study that I'm referencing put a dollar amount on the actual cost of health disparities. And this was a national study, looked at costs both direct and indirect over 3 years. And the dollar amount nationally was $1.24 trillion. And if we only looked at direct medical care expenditures in these 3 years, the cost was $2.29 billion. So knowing that we have communities where there's significant diversity in our Medicaid population, it's going to be really challenging to meet our goal without addressing health inequities. So what we know is that 40% of the Oregon Health Plan enrollees are people of color. What we don't know, because of the quality of our data at this point, is within the white population of the Oregon Health Plan, how many of those are Eastern European immigrants or refugees. 18 of Oregon's counties have a Medicaid population that is more than 25% non-white. 8 have Medicaid populations that are more than 50% non-white. And 3 counties have a Medicaid population that is majority Hispanic. And this slide shows that when we think about diversity across the state of Oregon, it's not, as many people believe, the diversity is not solely located in the metro area. It actually spans the state. So how can health systems promote health equity? Well, the good news is that there's a lot that can be done, and there are roadmaps and blueprints that exist and best practices that include all aspects of health-promoting organizations, from human resources to communications to service providers and the front desk staff. So the Institute of Medicine report presented a number of recommendations. I'll highlight 2 of them. Number six and number 8 are ones that you'll be talking about later today. Their recommendation number 6 was to collect and monitor data on patients' access and utilization of healthcare services by race, ethnicity, and primary language. And number 8, their recommendation was to provide healthcare professionals with tools to understand and manage the cultural and linguistic diversity of patients seen in today's health systems and avoid allowing unconscious biases and stereotypes to affect their interactions with patients, both during training of future healthcare providers and through practitioner continuing education. The Joint Commission, which accredits many of the hospitals and larger health systems and some federally qualified health centers, also has recently implemented standards for promoting health equity and patient-centered care. And I'll focus on the third one. They have requirements for the collection of patient-level demographic data on preferred language, race, and ethnicity in order to provide hospitals with information on the potential needs of each patient and to monitor and analyze health disparities at the population level. This is a blueprint that was, or a summary of a blueprint that was published by the National Public Health and Hospital Institute in partnership with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And I think a lot of folks are familiar with Don Berwick. And I'll focus here on the third and the fifth bullet. They recommend in their blueprint, providing evidence-based care to all patients in a culturally and linguistically appropriate manner. And number five, communicating in the patient's language and that providers understand and be responsive to cultural needs and expectations. And then the National Committee for Quality Assurance, they have established a distinction in multicultural healthcare, which any health system can apply for that distinction. But they have to meet certain standards, one of which is collecting race, ethnicity, and language data, using a system of effective data storage and retrieval for ethnic and linguistic information, reporting the HEDIS diversity of membership measures, and then identifying threshold languages spoken by 5% of the membership or 1,000 members, and then that would trigger different kinds of ways that the health system would respond in terms of having on-site healthcare interpretation and proper signage and proper translation of documents. They also focus on reducing healthcare disparities, again, collecting, reporting, and analyzing clinical quality and patient experience measures by race, ethnicity, and primary language, and comparing outcomes among members of different backgrounds so that the health systems can make targeted interventions to improve disparities in relevant care measures and continually evaluate their effectiveness. So just in closure, almost 50 years ago, President Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Act, which was not only a watershed moment for civil rights, but it also created a platform on which many could begin to build, to move toward health equity. I think many people, you know, for over the span of our history, we're really a generation in to closing some of these devastating health care gaps that are affecting many populations in Oregon. With increasing diversity among medical health research and public health professionals, we've increased our focus on health disparities and health equities. And the wonderful thing is that we can learn from the efforts of the National, the Institute of Medicine, the Joint Commission, the National Committee for Quality Assurance, and increasingly from hospitals and health systems in Oregon who are implementing health systems transformation to identify strategies that can help Oregonians achieve the highest possible level of health while decreasing costs and improving quality. I'm going to take any questions if there's time.
Well, how about we give you an opportunity? Do you want to comment on either of the bills coming? I know you can't take a position on them formally.
I cannot take a position on them.
However, would you care to comment on them?
Yeah, both of the bills that are coming forward, I think, align with a lot of the information that I've shared with you today. We have been working in the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services together to identify the disparities that exist. Gloria Anderson's also here and can talk a lot about it from a human services perspective. But we know that there are disparities. We know that collecting better data can help us to know how to target our interventions and how to invest our dollars most appropriately to close those gaps. And we also did staff a committee focused on cultural competence, continuing education, based on a willingness and an interest from a number of stakeholders across the board. Who were interested in understanding what cultural competence continuing education options exist and what the research is that supports that. So that report is available. We can share it with you if you're interested in that as well.
Misha, thank you very much. Are there other questions? President Thompson.
Are there ways to incrementally adopt this over a period of time in a stepwise fashion? I know what you're saying, and I don't disagree with any of it, but the problem we have is the problem is so big. Has anyone taken basically what you presented today and said, let's do this piece and this piece and this piece in order of, so we can have something to build on a foundation?
We do not have a specific plan for how to address health inequities statewide. Washington State, a number of states have developed their plan for eliminating health inequities. We haven't done that.
One of my concerns is we tend, and we've done this in other areas, we adopt a new policy that this is the direction we're going to do, and then we throw it on the wall, and it kind of collapses under its own weight. There aren't enough resources or people, which are resources, or not, to make it all happen. So there has to be a strategy for what do we do on day one, two, three, four, down the line, or year one, two, three, four. What are the biggest problems that we can address within the system we're in? One of them that I'm very concerned about, and it comes out to this very, very big, is I still do not believe as we do this flip to transformation, we have enough primary care provider bodies. And that I know we don't have enough primary care physicians. That's over. But how do we address all of this and healthcare transformation with the people we have on the ground, utilizing them differently? And I think this feeds right into that, because my guess is, in a constricted situation, a lot of your people are going to get more left out if we don't find a way to encompass the whole thing. And initially, it is my hope that we'll find a way to take all the qualifying patients, put them into medical care for at least a baseline study, an evaluation of where they are as individuals. That's a Herculean task. So the last thing I want to do is provide coverage to a huge number of people that can't get in to see a doctor. That's not healthcare. That's something else. And so it's how do we make all of this work in an equitable fashion with the resources we need? I don't know.
So one of the things that I would just offer is a lot of what we have offered up as best practices are already built into health systems transformation. So this is really about thinking, you know, providers outside of Medicaid right now, that's huge. How do we assure cultural competence there? The standards around race, ethnicity, and language data, there are some standards that exist. We can do more as agencies to support our providers in knowing exactly who they're already working with so that they can work with them more effectively.
If she wants to be. You have a question. Here's a chance.
Well, I know that you've been doing a lot of work on the culturally competent care piece over the last couple of years. And I'm just wondering whether it's more appropriate to ask her about that now or wait until we actually hear that bill.
She hasn't volunteered to testify. So you have her in front of you now.
Hey. So we're going a little out of order. We've got the data equity bill and then the cultural competency. But I know that you've been doing a lot of work on that with a big task force. So maybe you could let us know a little about that before we formally open the hearings on each of those bills.
Sure. The Cultural Competence Continuing Education Committee, it's a big mouthful. We couldn't make a nice acronym out of it. We pulled together representatives from the licensing boards, from the healthcare professional associations, from individual practitioners, academics, community members to look at three things. One was, can we identify a solid definition of cultural competence? That was something that had come up before. So what's the best definition of cultural competence? And are there standards for what would count as cultural competence continuing education? We hadn't identified those before. So we wanted, you know, we had heard from folks that, you know, there's some good cultural competence continuing education, and there's some that, you know, maybe isn't so good. So what's a standard? So that was the first task. The second task was to identify what are the continuing education options that exist, whether they're online, in-person, service learning. And what we found there was, like, it was this giant apple that we could only take a bite out of because... So, like I mentioned before, there are so many entities that are now looking at cultural competence continuing education that there's just more and more continuing education options that are being developed. So we identified a number of them. that would also address some of the issues that were, had been raised around geographic access or specific professional discipline. So we pulled those together as well. And then the third piece that we looked at was what are some of the logistical challenges that the licensing boards would have to address in order to encourage their licensees, if, you know, it was about encouraging, or in order to mandate that their licensees participate in cultural competence continuing education. So we came up with a number of recommendations, some of which I think are very doable within the resources that we currently have. So, our co-chair of the committee is also here, and I believe she's going to testify on it as well.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
My turn.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just sitting back and listening to kind of some of the issues that you're talking about that we're facing and stuff in the healthcare industry, I'm wondering if the picture isn't much larger than what you're bringing up. We have 44% of the Oregon people on the Oregon Health Plan are minorities. And we're talking diabetes, and you have two types of diabetes, type 1, type 2. Type 1, juvenile diabetes, nothing we can do about. That's a disease that a child lives with forever. I have a son who has type 1 diabetes. Type 2, I'm wondering if we shouldn't be looking at some of the eating habits and some of the cultural things that are going on, where we start looking at our SNAP program and setting it up to where it's more like WIC, where these are the foods you can buy, these are the foods you can't, to start driving the proper behavior to get people off of basically type 2 diabetics, to where they don't need insulin, they don't need things, they don't have to go there. And I wonder if this has been investigated by you and your department at all, because you're talking about them driving by all the fast food places. But if we put the two together, kind of the carrot and stick, hey, if you're eating right, you're going to get this. But if you're stopping and getting all the junk food at McDonald's and everything else,
wait,
then you start
here
taking it away. Well, I kind of want to spill the whole thing out to let her respond to the whole thing.
I think she gets your point.
No, I think it's a great question, and I'm sure that there's a lot of research on, you know, whether the best investment is focused on individual behavior change, or, you know, the public health approach is more focused on how do we make it easier for people to make a healthy choice, so the carrot and stick. I can do a little more research and get back with you on kind of how they weigh out in terms of what's most effective. You know, when we think about it, there, it's probably a both and, that there has to be some individual behavior change, but there's also the investments that need to be made at the city or county level, the, you know, the city planners. Do people have access to exercise? Can they, is there a sidewalk that they can walk on? Is it in a safe neighborhood? Is it lit? Are there curb cuts if people, you know, have a mobility issue? So there's probably, it's a both and. But I'd be happy to follow up with you and talk more about it.
Okay. Tricia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the informational meeting on health equity and access. And just a couple of comments before I move forward. A supplement to the announcement on the work group on the role of citizen advisory committees and CCOs, Representative Lively has also agreed to join Representative Thompson in that work. We'll be looking both for possible legislation for this session, but if not, carrying it into the interim. This is a, I think, a very important topic, and we'll make sure we'll get to it next year. I'm going to open up a public hearing on both bills. We're not prepared to move either of them today, but we'll use the time we can to get testimony on it. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2611 and on House Bill 2134. To facilitate, if any of you testifying on one want to comment on the other, you're welcome to. And I've asked my vice chair to introduce these to us.
Okay, great. Very excited to introduce these two bills. They're really a huge piece of the passion I have around how are we going to bend that cost curve and really meet the needs of our population in Oregon that's growing in diversity. So the first one is House Bill 2134, which requires Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services to adopt by rule uniform standards for collection of data on race, ethnicity, and preferred languages of medical assistance recipients. Provides that standards must be based on local, statewide, and national best practices for data collection. Do I need to officially read the rest of it? Okay. And the second one is House Bill 2611, requires specified health regulatory boards to adopt rules by January 1st, 2017, requiring licensees to document participation in continuing education approved by Oregon Health Authority to reduce health disparities and improve cultural competency. Requires OHA to collaborate with boards to define cultural competency, develop a list of continuing education opportunities, and provide list to boards on or before January 1st, 2015. And we have Representative Joe.
No, we're going to start first. Let me call first. We have four witnesses on House Bill 2134. Let's start with those. We have three supporting and one opposed, so we'll start with the three supporting. And apologize. There's a note here that says please print legibly. That's apparently a complicated thing to do, so I can't quite get the names right, either my eyes or the printing. But let's start with Joseph Santos Lyons. Kalpan, is that? And the last name? Last name, I can't even
Christian
guess
Martin.
It.
Sorry.
And no. And Alberta, probably Moreno. Representative Gallegos, how about joining us up here while you're waiting to testify on the next one?
Well, I'm fine down here.
Okay. I don't know. He's not ready for hazard pay, I guess. Please.
Great. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the director of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. We're a statewide community organization that works to ensure that Asians and Pacific Islanders are fully engaged in the social, economic, and political issues that affect us. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2134. We believe in an Oregon where everyone has access to the health care they need and that good health is the foundation for community prosperity. For generations, our communities have made contributions to our economy and society, yet still some of our communities face persistent disparities in health and human services. We know that despite our best efforts, real differences exist in the outcomes of various communities. These differences have been well documented, for example, in the Coalition of Communities of Color Unsettling Profile and the Oregon State of Equity Reports. Oregon currently has data gaps and outdated collection practices that are problematic and need modest adjustments. For example, Asian and Pacific Islanders, when grouped in overall averages, fall short of any useful purpose. Inconsistencies in data collection, for example, collecting data on Asians and Pacific Islanders as other or only Asian, rules out meaningful use of data within and across state agencies that provide services. We need good data to help us tailor services to the needs of our diverse communities. We know that the wrong focus equals the wrong results. Collecting accurate information about race, ethnicity, and language and disability status in a uniform, practical, and culturally appropriate format is critical to improving the effectiveness and efficiency of programs and services and is also a proven strategy to eliminate disparities. We work closely with OHA and DHS staff over the last several years to develop best practices, policies, and around the development of House Bill 2134 and the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you. This bill gives rulemaking authority to the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services to adopt uniform standards based on best practices for the collection of data on race, ethnicity, language, and disability status. The bill provides for ongoing stakeholder engagement and a review and update of the standards every 2 years to stay current with best practices. House Bill 2134 does not have an implementation deadline, but does require OHA and DHS to report back to you by June of 2014 on the uniform standards and plan for implementation across the agencies. The bill is supported by over 38 community organizations, and we have submitted 18 letters of support from health and human service groups and professionals. And we want to make sure that all Oregonians get the best care possible. We ask that you pass this bill with the Dash 1 amendments, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee.
Dash 1s are in the packet in front of you, incidentally. Thank you. Any questions?
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Kalpana Krishnamurthy, and for the past 8 years, I've been the RACE Program Director at the Western State Center. Western State Center was one of seven organizations that spearheaded the 2011 Oregon Legislative Report Card on Racial Equity, and I served as the primary researcher and author, which means I was looking for a lot of data in the course of writing that report card. Uniform data collection was one of the top recommendations in the 2011 report card, and it HB 2134 is one of the bills that is being considered for the 2013 Racial Equity Report Card. So as you've just heard from Tricia Tillman, health disparities are really the population-specific differences in disease, in health outcomes, or in access to health care. And here in Oregon, far too many of those disparities fall specifically along race and ethnic lines. And what the practical meaning of this is that Oregonians of color are sicker and more likely to die than white Oregonians. And some recent statistics, you know, that just to think about around the diabetes question, black Oregonians are three times more likely to die from diabetes than white Oregonians. We know that the low birth weight for African American communities is 50% more likely than white babies. We know the infant mortality rate for African American babies in the state of Oregon is somewhere between Sri Lanka and Uruguay. Right. We also know that breast cancer. We know that breast cancer, one of the most curable types of cancer, is the leading cause of cancer deaths amongst Latina and Asian Pacific Islander women. And we also know that American Indians and Alaska Natives have some of the highest death rates due to chronic lower respiratory disease as well as unintentional injury. So having the data is critically important to understanding the type of intervention that's needed to change these outcomes over the long haul. Having data on patient race, ethnicity, and language would allow researchers to better analyze the factors that are associated with these healthcare disparities, and this can help healthcare systems to monitor performance, to ensure accountability to the enrolled members, to improve patient choice, and to allow for evaluation of successful intervention programs. Uniform data on racial, ethnic, and language differences in healthcare is generally speaking unavailable. Federal, private, and state-supported data collection efforts are extremely scattered and very inconsistent. And many health plans, with a few notable exceptions, don't even collect data on enrollees' race, ethnicity, or primary language. Here in Oregon, the recent State of Equity report found that not every division collects participant data, even though there are guidelines in place. So this is completely in alignment, as you heard from Tricia, with recognized practices in the medical community and is seen as a way to improve quality of care and health outcomes. Nationally, both the American Medical Association and the Institute of Medicine recommend collecting data, and this has also been a recommendation made by the Governor's 2000 Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force and subsequent health equity task forces over the past 13 years. 2134 brings us into alignment with some of the emerging practices to address health disparities. For example, Multnomah County's Health Equity Initiative is pursuing a similar approach to require all county health departments that provide direct services to collect race and ethnicity data that will allow disaggregation. We also have a moment with transformation coming up that's really critical. Given the Affordable Care Act, the health transformation, and new data systems, HB 2134 gives us a chance to actually practice looking at how we can collect data before we see a huge influx of new people into the system. And this is an incredibly timely bill that allows us to test and evaluate some important systems. So that's why we urge the supporting of 2134 and the Dash 1 amendments.
Representative Greenlick, Esteemed members of the committee, thank you for having this conversation with us today. My name is Alberto Moreno. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I'm also a commissioner on the Governor's Commission for Hispanic Affairs. We're delighted to be here with you today. Before we proceed, I want to recognize the great work of Ms. Tricia Tillman, but I also want to recognize her predecessor, Dr. James Mason, who is in the audience with us today. And so just want to call out that this is really legacy work. This is a continuation of many, many decades worth of work, and we hope to be able to count on your support at the end of the day. But you're wondering, why are we here today? Why are we here in this moment in Oregon's history? We are here because we are tired of being invisible. We are here because our children want to, need to be seen. Our mothers and sisters counted. Our language is heard, languages like Triqui, Mixteco, Canjoval. We need our labor recorded and valued. We want to register our state on our state's ledgers, recorded on your actuarials, our taxes and tidings counted on revenue lines. But simple numbers are not enough. We know, for example, that there are 174,000 migrant and seasonal farm workers who contribute over $5 billion with a B, in annual agricultural activity to our great state. And yet, their life expectancy is 49 years of age. And although these workers make significant contributions to our state's economy, we cannot say with certainty how many are reporting cancer from pesticide exposure. We cannot say how many are suffering from respiratory illness as a result of the poor living conditions present in those mold-infested shacks. We cannot say how many of our children are suffering from repetitive movement injuries because they are at the tender ages of 8, 9, and 10 working in the fields with their parents. We cannot say with absolute certainty how many of our indigenous migrant sisters and daughters are being sexually assaulted in the fields, in our hotels, or in their transport from work sites to work sites. We want to be seen and our many contributions recorded. How else are we to know if, as a state, we have kept our promise? How else shall we know if we have met our promise of narrowing the great divide between the reality of our communities and the great promise of the state? How else are we to know if everyone in our state enjoys the same freedom, the same health, the same opportunity and protection dreamed of by our forefathers? Or if we have, in our journeying to equality, left some behind? We need your help so that soon we can point to a map of the state and say, this is us, this is our state, this is our Oregon too, and know, finally, and with certainty, that we count, that we matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pena. Are there any questions or any of the panel?
All right.
Not the same question, though. It has to be a different one. Go ahead.
It'll be different this time. Because we're dealing with health inequity with minorities and stuff, and it's one of the things my wife and I've had a discussion on quite a bit. My father-in-law actually came from a different country, so my wife grew up in Woodburn, and she talked about when she remembers a lot of the women in her community, they would go back to Mexico to have their children because it was less expensive. But once we basically gave free health care, they started staying here and having their children. I'm just wondering how they were being discriminated against in this with the free health care, because we kind of changed and made things easier for them. So how are we making it a little more difficult for them with the inequity?
Representative Widener, I don't know that that is the experience of our community. I appreciate your wife's and yours experience, but what we actually have seen is that there's been a decrease in migration into the state of Oregon. That indeed those, what used to be linear migration patterns have become circular and smaller. We don't believe that our mothers, that our daughters journey across 3,000 miles worth of desert and difficult terrain to just to get health care. There is health care in Mexico. We journey here for the opportunity that this great nation provides, but at no time do we make a decision to leave our children behind, to leave our parents behind, to leave our language behind, simply to have health insurance. It doesn't enter into our conversation, into our calculus. There's great cost to the very act of migration. And we have all done it. This country is based on that rich tradition of migration, with the first immigrants being the pilgrims. We want to make sure that this country continues to benefit from the labor, the possibility and the promise of that diverse workforce. And so we're joined with you today to ask for that to happen, for us to have a healthy workforce, so that that $5 billion contribution that we talked about gets to grow to $7 billion, based and supported by the labor of these folks.
I may follow up.
I think this is out of order. I don't think it's relevant to the bill we're talking about today.
So, well, it's health equity. So
the bill is about data collection.
Yeah. So, and I'm just, but it's what I'm trying to get at is the data collection and why some of this has changed. So, because I think there's lots of variables that are into why the migrants have stopped moving in and things like that. So with the
bill's so, about healthcare data collection, perhaps in mind.
Yeah.
We can deal with the elements of immigration policy in when we have a bill in front of us that relates to immigration policy. Yes, sir.
Do we have models and programs in place for collecting this data? I mean, we know what we want to collect, and we're just not doing it?
Yes, sir. Chair and Representative Thompson, we would like to see us move to universally using the Census 2010 standard for the collection of race, ethnicity, and language. And actually, we should have before you a schema of the different standards that have developed over the last 20 years. We can make that available to the committee right away if you'd like to see it as well. The Partners for Quality Care has also done some extensive research on what the best practices would be for Oregon and what some of the languages
that's
and ethnicities
would be. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
There are also other states that have data collection bills in place, and so I think groups are looking at other states and trying to understand how the data is coming back and what it's informing those states on.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you.
Can I call Ed Johnston, please?
Good afternoon. My straw man accountant is Edward Johnston. I'm here speaking against this data collection. We have enough data in this community and this state. People are tired of the 4th, 14th, and 16th Amendment violated. This does do that. This is very horrifying that we live in this type of society, especially with this health care problems, even with illegals in our country. I have 17 blown discs, half my neck's titanium. My kidneys are failing. My lungs are failing, and most people in this building know, especially when 2005, when I went down to the child care prevention and reporting class, the Adolf Hitler bill that was passed in 1999, 449 was the bill. I was arrested for going down there for Senator Gary George. People need to know what's really going on in this state. We have a constitutional born right in this country. Not a privilege, and only legal Americans by the Second Amendment, by two or more generations, by federal law, are legal Americans. It is very disturbing with the data collection going on, and the structure violating people's rights to violate their, to put them in contract law and signing their rights and families of rights over to the state or any corporation agency. That's illegal by federal law. using the police departments in these factions for data collection that actually do use, because I'm dealing with that, where they've tried to throw me off my property. Last February was the last assassination attempt on me by Toledo Police Department, when Toledo Police Department robbed my home of my medical bills and 20 years of work I did up at this Capitol. And I'm very disturbed about that, because we were filing cases on the racketeering fraud and extortion. This is why I have formed elected and public employees oversight committees and educating people on this matter, to go and educate themselves how to file against elected and public employees violating their constitutional oath. Data collection is one of these things that violate their constitutional oath, unless you want to voluntarily give your information. November 5th or 7th this year, because of the corruption in this state and what I'm dealing with, and most people, some people know me in this building, what I've dealt with over the years. Now, my doctor tells me he can't see me again, gives me heart pills, because the city of Toledo tried to file a whole bunch of false police reports on me like they did in 2006, when the Inspector General's report said the Democratic Party had a personal vendetta out because I'm a sovereign citizen or my political points of view. Now, for our medical society, the one simple solution we could do for legal Americans is let's use a House Resolution 192. That was a 1933 Banking Act bill, and educate the kids on their UCC code filing. If you want, if the state wants their money that corruption that bad, let them bill it to the Treasury like House Resolution 192 is designed for. If we're going to protect our citizens in this manner with medical and especially data collection, because that's illegal by the Constitution, because now you're making different class of people. Under the Constitution, there is no race. There is no color. There is no creed. It's all one for all. We're all one color. So if we have to data collect on each other so we can sit there and invade people's homes because we think they're not living correctly, when some agency decides that has no legal authority, like the police departments don't have legal authority, nor the court enforcers in the state of Oregon. Their job legally by federal and state law is to protect the citizens by 164.075 and cite and monitor the public employees for violating their oath as well as what they are violating on their own property. That's the way it really works. I've done the research. I've got the evidence. People know me up there for 20 years. Not only that, I'm going to be turning in a bombshell case here today that was passed 12-12 by the Supreme
Mr. Johnson,
Court.
And
it has a lot to do with data. Let me.
Can I ask you to keep your testimony?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Is it health data?
Yes, this has effect because it all affects, because all the data and all this collection has a right, because our constitutional rights are being violated by this data. The bombshell case that went on.
State is all voluntary. There's no.
I know it's all voluntary, but most people don't understand that. They get talked into buying a driver's license, signing. They get talked into going along, let's say, with a concealed license permit. That's federally illegal. It's voluntary. You're absolutely correct, Chair Greenlink. That is true. It is voluntary. But as 12-12, the Supreme Court came out with a decision that says all positions are vacated. Sheriff, Senate, House, Congress, all vacated. I'm turning this in for evidence. Now, I don't have a problem with our public employees out there in our system because we need to have a balance. But when the system has gone to abuse and we're giving other people privileges above legal Americans, that's where the problem has to stop. Legal Americans have more authority. And when you're trying to make different races more and other to raise funding for different agencies, to create more debt on a straw man account for others, or if they're bringing them in and you're writing that off for the health care, putting them on the straw man account to write off debt for the state, I mean, this is somewhere it's got to stop. And people are getting really familiar with that now and getting educated. And what the whole frustrating point with the data, it is misused all the time for the agency's benefit. And I will end with that, but I will turn in this evidence, and I will send you, the committee, all some other stuff I've put up that I sent. I got a couple of bills, ideas that I sent up, that to protect our sovereignty instead of being violating and have further charges brought against members, because people are understanding and asking questions to learn how to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. And by the way, I am the president of the Elected and Public Employees Oversight Committee as the president of the United States Court Watch Association, so we can educate them on the legal realities of our court and medical system. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We're going to close the public hearing on on House Bill 2134 and open up a work session simply for the purpose of adopting the Dash One amendments, and we'll be able to get all the paperwork we need to move the bill along. Madam Vice Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash One amendments dated 2-8-13.
Representative
on House Bill 2134.
Moves the Dash One amendments to House Bill 2134 dated
2-8-13.
Is there any discussion? This adds disability status to that. Is there any objection? Dash One's become a part of the bill, and we'll close the public the work session on House Bill 2134 and carry it over to Monday. To continue the public hearing on House Bill 2611, I'd like to call Representative Joe Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and esteemed members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Gallegos. I am the House Representative for House District 30, which is Hillsborough, Helvetia Corridor, North Plains. And I'm very pleased to be here today to talk to you about House Bill 2611. Forgive me, I'm on the back end of a cold, so I'm in the right committee for sure. Before I start,
I think we came to help you.
Yeah, right. Before I start, I do want to thank Representatives Lou Frederick and Alyssa Kenny Geyer for their leadership in helping to bring this issue to the fore, as well as other representatives, senators who have worked hard to do this. You know, some of you might know that before I became a member of the legislature, and this is my second week, I was a professor at the University of Portland, a member of the Department of Behavioral and Social Sciences, and I had a specialization in cross-cultural mental health. Through my work, I've long researched the concept of cultural competency in healthcare and the effects on both providers and patients. I've I'm credited with in the literature with having initiated the concept of cultural competence, if you can believe that. Back in 1982, an article that I published when I was at University of Washington, and I just share that with you. Actually, during one of my tenure reviews, I had a dean say, "You know, Joe, that's like Al Gore saying he invented the internet." But be that as it may. So, you know, I guess I'm raising that because this is really a special honor for me to be here and talk with you about cultural competency. I mean, recognize that this has been 30 years that this idea has been out there, and here we are. And hopefully we are at a juncture. You know, I guess I don't say that in a way of pejorative way at all. Rather, to me, what it's about is fascinating that institutions take a while to catch up. And what I propose is that that's where we're at, is institutionally getting at a place where we're recognizing that cultural competency is something that we'll all benefit from. So. So my research, along with my research, many other qualified people have found that when healthcare providers understand the culture of those they serve, the health of their patients improves, and the long-term healthcare costs are reduced. And I think that's a major point I want us to recognize, is that cultural competency reduces healthcare costs in the long run. Cultural competency is essential for assuring healthcare quality, decreasing medical costs by enhancing patient-provider communication, increasing the rate of accurate diagnosis and patient compliance, as well as decreasing the duplication of services and as well as unnecessary emergency room visits. Research shows that culturally competent training of health providers leads to improved patient outcomes. Currently, there are no standards for cultural competence training requirements for continuing education of licensed healthcare providers. Healthcare providers should be trained in the provision of culturally competent services in order to begin to reduce healthcare costs and build healthcare or a healthier Oregon. To achieve such a state, we need to address racial disparities in chronic health conditions and to provide routine health services in a culturally competent manner. So again, just to summarize, establishing cultural competency standards in healthcare training is simply an element needed to improve patient care and health outcomes and also to reduce those healthcare costs. Thank you. That's my statement.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Some people think this is a hard thing to do, and in this bill, the bill is about boards creating models for dealing. Do you think it's feasible in the wildest stretch of your imagination that within 4 years a board could figure out how to do this?
That's a tricky question. My standard response
to
that
question. It's a softball,
I thought. I know. Cultural competence is very simple. It's a very simple concept. All it means is you incorporate the variable of culture into the helping or healthcare process. It's that simple. You just think about culture as part of your process. On the other hand, that's an extremely complicated and complex thing to do. And that's why you need training. That's why you need some training so that you understand cultural competence is both a process and an outcome. So the outcome is achieving sort of a good fit between a health provider and their patient, but it's also a way of providing services as well. So it's a very simple thing, but it's a very complicated thing as well. How do you like that answer? Very political answer, I'm sure.
Yeah. What did you say? Thank you.
Sure.
Yes.
Yes.
Just real quick, said my staff just kind of pulled the numbers on this. I mean, and I'm trying to see where the cost reduction would actually be because you're 140 over
about
145,000 people that are probably going to need trained. And I would think out of that, you would try to find like a doctor or medical physician that understands your culture if you want to. I've never ran into it. I mean, I have a father-in-law who barely speaks English. My wife goes and interprets for him.
Sure.
And he's never ran into where he's had any issues with any of the doctors that he has to deal with. So
I can't find any that understand me.
Yeah. I have troubles understanding.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Wagner. That's a great question. And note that I said in the long run, healthcare costs are reduced. Actually, there was a study done back in the 70s by a fellow named Tom Owen, working for the National Institute of Mental Health. And Tom actually did sort of the initial study, the cost-benefit study on cultural competency in the Chinese community in San Francisco. And his study showed that it was basically on the welfare department down there. And his study showed that if you had sort of cultural congruence between the provider and the recipient, that, again, you cut down on recidivism, you cut down on returns, you cut down on emergency visits, those kinds of things. So, again, in the front end, yeah, it'll probably cost a bit, and you'll probably see that in your financials that it's going to cost. But in the long run, is where we're talking about the cost savings. Yeah.
Just quick follow up because I can see some huge expenses here with my wife doing interpreting some of the things. I've seen where it's affected actually other people negatively, where they've used her as an advantage to keep her employed, where other union members have been bumped because they'll write in a piece for her language. And she even says it's wrong, some of the stuff that's going on when we start going down this road.
My position is that I'm not in favor of using interpreters, period. I think if you have to, if there's nothing else, but you're right, interpreters tend to muddy up the interaction.
Yeah. And one more quick follow-up. Come over here.
All right. Very quick.
Because when we start going down here, I just worry about us actually creating more barriers than actually keeping things open. And I'm just wondering, with what we're doing and looking at the list of people that we have on this chart, if we might actually start creating more barriers rather than putting more, letting the burden lie on the patient themselves to go find somebody who's culturally competent form by forcing everybody else to become culturally competent for 20 different cultures.
Right. In response to that, what I would suggest is that what's the alternative? Is the alternative to continue to not serve a large portion of the community? I mean, I just don't think there's an alternative, frankly.
Senator Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting in the context of our whole effort to bend the cost curve, which, you know, this committee and the legislature has obviously taken up. I think I understand the motivation behind this, and it seems to me that it's consistent with a lot of the things that we're trying to do. But the concern that I have about it is that you heard the number of licensees, I assume, that would have to be trained. Let's assume that they took 3 hours of continuing education per year. That's something like almost 450,000 hours of time of healthcare providers that would be taken out of whatever else it could be put into. And there is a cost and a benefit, and you know, set aside the dollar amount, I'm not sure what that would be, but there's certainly a diversion of resources. And in all of what we're doing, I think there is a cumulative effect of pulling providers away from interacting with patients. And while I don't know what the best use of their time is, I'm not sure it's this, I'm not sure it's not, but I know that they won't be doing something else. And maybe we need to consider, first of all, what the scope of the problem is and whether it would be better for them as providers and better for our efforts as policymakers to have them look at, you know, take continuing legal education on managing diabetes, for example, something that is, and again, I'm not making a value judgment about what's better. I'm saying, would that actually have a better result?
Right. Yeah, no, and I think that's a fair question. I think the response needs to be, as you're suggesting, you know, how do we put a cost-benefit with regard to those 3 hours? And my guess would be that, you would eventually show a cost savings in terms of the eventual long-term costs again. But I think that's right.
Representative Gallegos, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have two more panels of three I'd like to call. Let me call, we're getting close to time. The first panel, Fabiana Wallace, Ron Williams, and Nancy Nickel. You pick the order.
Sorry, it's my first time testifying. So, Chair Greenlick, and
only one rule: I said you introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Fabiana Wallace, and I'm a clinical psychologist in private practice in Northeast Portland. I also served on the Cultural Competence Continuing Education Committee that Tricia described earlier. I'm in complete support of this bill, and I would like to focus on two key aspects of the bill to build on what has already been said. The first part is the need for a requirement. Knowing how to bridge any of the many possible differences that might exist between a provider and a patient and how that might impact the relationship is not an option. When people in Oregon say that the population is not diverse enough to require competence, cultural competence training, they're likely thinking only about minorities that they can see. And although we have data, like Tricia presented, that there are more people of color than many people think about, there's still a lot of invisible minority categories that I would like to read a list of the general categories, which is expressed or perceived race, color, spiritual beliefs, creed, age, tribal affiliation, national origin, immigration or refugee status, ethnicity, marital status, socioeconomic status, veteran status, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, and gender transition, level of formal education, physical or mental disability, or medical condition. So most of these are invisible. Therefore, implementing a universal approach to cultural competence makes sense. Providing healthcare services that meet or exceed the standard of care to all patients is an integral aspect of ethical practice. Ignoring or minimizing differences, imposing providers' worldview on their patients, and making assumptions about the patient that impact their care are against ethical practice. Just as ethical practice is not optional, nor should cultural competence be optional. There is also a common misconception that cultural competence is an area of specialty that is relevant only to providers like myself who work primarily with minority populations. However, cultural competence is a lens that must guide all doctor-patient relationships, since it is impossible to determine solely by sight or by last name, for example, if somebody may be a member of a minority group. The specialties perspective also allows providers to opt out of addressing differences that might impact healthcare. The current optional policy of culturally competent care has led to significant and documented health disparities in Oregon. Minority providers or majority allies are not naturally culturally competent either, and therefore all providers require training in this area. All providers may be vulnerable to their own biases or blind spots. No two people are alike or have the same life experiences. So even if a provider and a patient might be matched culturally, they might not be matched in other ways. And so it is important also that, given that current health reform strongly emphasizes integrated care and multidisciplinary teams, that we see cultural competence training across all the different healthcare professions as contributing to a common set of skills across differences. Requiring cultural competency training will only enhance the integrated approach to healthcare. I would like to add, as a provider of direct services, that just to clarify in the continuing education aspect, is that this bill doesn't create a new requirement per se, because all of us need to, maybe except nurses in the state of Oregon, have already a requirement to take cultural competency education credits. We pay out of our own pockets for these. Nobody offers us cultural competence or any other continuing education credit for free. So calculating by hours that providers are going to be trained, actually that usually comes from the provider's own expense. There are free cultural competence trainings that are available online.
May I ask you to wind up, please?
Okay. So I just wanted to clarify that in terms of the cost piece. And the other part, that there's a need for training standards. And there's a robust body of literature that describes that standards are important in cultural competence in areas of awareness, knowledge, and skills. And I think there's a great responsibility that accompanies any requirement. And so if we're going to have people take these classes, we want to ensure that they're useful and that providers come out of these trainings knowing having knowledge and skills on how to implement them. And there's a lot of detail on the standards in the report that Tricia mentioned earlier today. More information.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, committee members. My name is Ron Williams. I'm the executive director
of Oregon Action, which is a statewide network of people and organizations dedicated to social, racial, and economic justice through individual and group empowerment. We have an office in Portland, office in Medford, and we have about 6,000 members statewide. Oregon Action fully supports passage of this legislation because we believe that it will go a long way towards improving the patient experience, increasing the quality of care that folks in Oregon receive, and ultimately reduce health care costs. While Oregon's population is growing rapidly more diverse, there is also a growing concern that racial and ethnic populations, LGBT communities, low literacy level individuals, and rural Oregonians may be experiencing significant health disparities. In order for Oregon to achieve the triple aim of increased quality, improved patient experience, and lowering costs, providers must be responsive to the needs of the diverse populations living in our state. Cultural competence training for healthcare providers is one solution for helping the healthcare system adapt to the needs of Oregon's socially and culturally diverse communities. Cultural competence continuing education in Oregon would also align with national organizations and their efforts as well. Organizations that have recommended cultural competence training for their providers include, but are not limited to, the American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, the American Dental Association, the Association of American Medical Colleges, the American Academy of Pediatrics, among others. We feel that this alignment with national organizations and our shared goals of achieving the triple aim is a good thing. What we know is that cultural competency training is not currently offered in many health training professions, in many health professional training programs, and employers rarely offer it, despite data that shows the evidence of the effectiveness. House Bill 2611 will ensure that certain licensed health care providers have the tools they need to provide quality care to Oregon's increasingly diverse population. All people should have access to a basic level of quality care, and ensuring that all licensed health care providers in Oregon receive cultural competence training will help ensure that Oregonians receive that care. Sorry, I'm really thirsty. There's no water here.
We'll get you some water. Water coming.
Thank you very much.
Couldn't cure Representative Gallego's cold.
That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Nickel. I live in Portland. And I'm here to represent Portland Jobs with Justice. I'm a volunteer with that organization. And we support HB 2611. And I want to add, it's not in the testimony I submitted, but I'm a retired attorney, and effective, useful continuing education is required of attorneys, and we do it on our own dime, and we do it because it makes us more proficient. It made us better lawyers, and the bar required it so that we could serve our clients. And I don't think it's so onerous for a licensing board to require the people that they license to better meet the needs of their patients. So I don't think this is a very onerous requirement at all. So Jobs with Justice is a labor coalition. Essentially, it also has community and faith groups. And the reason we support this bill is because we believe that low-wage workers will benefit from cultural competency training of healthcare workers. We know that if a worker is not well, they can't work, or they might try to work, and they won't work very well because they're sick or they're hurt. Now, I'm not going to talk about whether or not that worker can even afford medical attention. Let's assume they can. Oregon's population is becoming more and more diverse, and that diversity is perhaps greatest among low-wage workers. So healthcare providers need to be equipped to serve the new cultures that are coming into their office. If a healthcare provider can't understand the culture of that worker, cannot communicate with that worker, there's going to be a real barrier to analyzing the problem that that person has. And the treatment outcome is not going to be as good as it could be if there was adequate communication. I mean, a lot of us have a hard time communicating with our healthcare provider, and we speak English. It's a healthcare literacy problem, and it's even greater if there's language and cultural problems. So if there's no communication or not good communication between an ill or hurt worker and their provider, and they don't get the care that they need, they might lose their job. And it might have been a healthcare problem that could have been taken care of if there had been better communication. This hurts the worker, it hurts their family, and it hurts the state. Because workers, these workers are our basis, they're our core. It has to be frustrating, too, for a healthcare worker to not be able to meet the needs of their patients. They're dedicated to that, and I think they might welcome, I can't speak for them, I shouldn't, but I would think they would welcome the opportunity to have the training and probably be glad they had it. I don't think they'd need it every year. So Jobs with Justice believes that the state of Oregon has a responsibility to set clear standards for culturally competent healthcare as licensors, and that they have an additional responsibility to provide the healthcare workers with the support they need to meet the standards, find the best programs, and make them available. We believe that HB 2611 should be enacted. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I call the next panel, let me take a moment to suspend things and open up a work session for the purpose of adopting 4 LCs as committee bills. You still have a quorum? Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 0089, dated 2/11/13.
Oh, thank you.
No questions. Does that mean no questions?
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm so good.
We're running out of time, so we're rushing through.
I'm
thank you.
Thanks
for the water.
LC 2684, dated 12/10/12. LC 0992, dated 2/15/13, and LC 2029, dated 11/28/12.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 0089, dated 2/11/13; LC 2684, dated 12/10/12; LC 0992, dated 2/15/13; and LC 2029, dated 11/28/12. Just to remind the committee, adopting these as committee bills no way indicates any measure of approval or disapproval of these bills. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to those to the motion? Maybe we better have a roll call. Let's see.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Excuse.
Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion passes. We have four more witnesses signed up for this bill. Let me see if you can rotate among the three chairs in some way that works. Ty Schwafferman first, James Mason, and Tassara Dudley, and Andrew Lubish. Lubish, is it?
Lubash.
Lubash, okay.
Do you want all four to come up?
If there's four chairs.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ty Schwafferman. I'm from Portland, and I represent the Urban League of Portland. I'm testifying in support of HB 2611. On Tuesday night, Oregonians proudly watched Governor John Kitzhaber as he sat in the presence of the elegant First Lady Michelle Obama as the president delivered the State of Union speech. We all know how hard we have all worked to address the growing cost of healthcare. And for Governor Kitzhaber receiving this national recognition by sitting in the First Lady's guest box on Tuesday. However, we know that there is much work that needs to be done to rein in healthcare costs. We cannot lose sight of the opportunity to add cultural competency training as a cost reduction strategy. National estimates show that nearly half of all newly eligible Medicaid and Medicare recipients will be Black and Latino. A report produced by the Health Costs and Utilization Project and Joint Centers of Political and Economic Studies in 2011 estimated that racial and ethnic disparities had a cost to the nation of nearly $1.2 trillion in the years 2003 to 2006. Cultural competency has been identified by the National Center for Disease Control, the Office of Multicultural Health, as one of the proven strategies to reducing healthcare costs and eliminating health disparities. Health professionals trained in cultural competencies have an increased rate of accurate diagnoses, according to many studies. Healthcare professionals need the skills necessary to elicit patients' understanding of illness and sickness. A great example of this is in the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down by Anne Fadima, which chronicles one Hmong family, a refugee family from Laos living in California, and their experiences with the healthcare system. Healthcare professionals have been building a body of knowledge in cultural practices and perceptions of healthcare. And yet, there's still no requirements that healthcare professionals are using these studies and valuable research in their practice. This can lead to just a duplication of services and unnecessary emergency room visits. I urge you to support cultural competency is just good healthcare. It's a movement, it's not just a bill. As part of healthcare transformation and a key cost-saving strategy. And I encourage the governor to take this up. Doctors and other healthcare workers should be required to have cultural competency training so that together we can begin to remove barriers to good healthcare, and together we can build a healthier Oregon while lowering costs. Thank you.
Hello, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Tassara Dudley, and I'm here with Andrew Lubash, and we're here today as representatives of the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students statewide from public universities and community colleges. This bill impacts us because we have healthcare centers on our college campuses, and some of us are becoming the future doctors and nurses of the great state of Oregon. I would like to speak to the value of having culturally competent healthcare providers on our college campuses, and then Andrew would like to talk about cultural competency education for nursing and medical school students. So, Oregon students are facing a problem. Healthcare providers on our campuses and in our communities don't always have the tools they need to provide safe, supportive healthcare to us. And we know that health is necessary for educational success. When students have access to quality healthcare, they're less likely to miss classes and more likely to achieve their educational goals. All of the Oregon University System schools provide some form of health insurance and on-campus access to licensed healthcare providers, mental health care, things like that. But unfortunately, the healthcare providers aren't currently required to undergo any sort of cultural competency training. And students from marginalized communities often choose not to visit doctors and healthcare professionals because they're afraid of being mistreated or of being forced to explain their identities or educate their healthcare providers. I myself, my partner, and people in my community have been denied access to potentially life-saving treatment until we have taken an HIV test or a pregnancy test or some test that's not medically necessary and not relevant to the care that we came in to receive. Culturally competent medical providers could explain the risks and benefits and make that decision with patients instead of for them. College campuses are becoming hubs of diversity in our state as we take on more out-of-state students and international students, and we encourage safety and inclusion for LGBT students for recruitment and retention purposes. We have to be able to provide good health care to everyone on our campus. We want our campus doctors and nurses to be culturally competent so that we don't have to delay preventative screenings or take two buses to reach a doctor that we know we can trust. As the Equal Rights Director for the Associated Students of Portland State University, I know that this issue is felt really widely in our campus, and I've had conversations with students about that. Students of color face language and cultural barriers, and LGBTQ students are often expected to educate their doctors about their identities and their needs. And we've been talking with many of you about the importance of this bill since SB 97 died in 2011. Now we're asking for your public support and a yes vote on HB 2611 because cultural competency is just about good health care.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and the esteemed members of the committee for allowing me to testify here today. For the record, my name is Andrew Lubash, and I'm a sophomore at the University of Oregon. I would like to add a little bit from the perspective of our medical school and nursing students. Currently, most medical school programs have no requirements for health professionals in training to complete even one course in cultural competency, despite research that shows that cultural competency training requirements lead to improved patient outcomes. Most schools put few resources towards diversity programming. These under-resourced departments are labeled with fancy titles, like the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, but the fact remains that these departments are never given the resources needed to implement truly comprehensive initiatives to increase cultural competency trainings on campus. Lectures, programming, and one-time events are not enough and cannot compare to a core curriculum standard for cultural competency. I've talked to pre-med students, and they've expressed disappointment to me over the lack of training they've received in order to prepare them to be truly effective healthcare providers. My friend Amy has this to say about this bill. Our healthcare professionals work diligently each day to provide superior care to all patients. Their hard work and service to this state does not go unnoticed. Patient backgrounds are often taken into consideration when formulating treatment plans. However, it is impossible to fully understand the needs of a community that you do not identify as until the issues are addressed and the impact is explained. End quote. If our healthcare professionals in Oregon are not being offered basic cultural competency training, they will be ill-equipped to serve the growing diversity of Oregon's population. Furthermore, professionals will not be as competitive in the 21st century workplace, which is trending towards increased inclusivity and acceptance. We know that there is opposition to this bill. Healthcare specialists are asking us to trust them, but we are asking that our healthcare specialists trust their patients to tell them that their needs aren't being met. The fact that this issue even needs a law, and so many people have been working to improve healthcare disparities with little results, is disappointing. A hearing like this is a high-stakes review process, and we feel the results of this review are not being taken seriously. It is time for cultural competency to be embedded into all basic medical trainings in our state, because it's a proven way to improve health outcomes. This legislation is good for students and healthcare providers and professionals alike. Please vote yes on HB 2611. Cultural competency is just good healthcare.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Dr. James Mason. I'm the Director of Diversity for Province Health and Services in the state of Oregon. Just wanted to suggest that Province supports the legislation. We believe the timeline is reasonable. We think the process being proposed is appropriate. What we also know is that culturally competent education can help our providers become more efficient and effective at providing quality care that is met with higher degrees of satisfaction and better outcomes. We also know that most culturally competent education models promote patient-centered care, which views everyone as having a culture, and we've heard a few people testify to that effect earlier today. It also suggests that everyone can be trained to work cross-culturally, which we think is also very important to keep in mind. Other reasons we support the legislation include our recognition of that Oregon is becoming much more diverse as a state, and various counties we see major emergence of diversity. We want to make sure that our providers and others are prepared to work cross-culturally. We also know that culture influences the way that people perceive illness and health, the way they recognize credible providers and treatment approaches, even how they define credible providers. We also understand this in terms of disparity reduction. We think as we make efforts to reduce disparities in various health disciplines, it will instill greater community trust in the work that we do, which allows us to be more credible in suggesting how they change their lifestyle to be more healthy in the 21st century. We also know that it enhances relationship between patient and provider, which results in greater treatment compliance. And we heard other people talk about it will also improve the way that people access health care currently, most notably staying out of health care emergency rooms. It has a likelihood of enhancing market share for us in private health care and service utilization for those in public health. We also know that it will help overcome our biases in our formal and informal education around diversity, around health care, and health and human services. We heard people speak to the idea of this is trending. We know that it's trending from the standpoint of accreditation, funding, and licensure. We think it also prepares for the 21st century in that regard as well. It assures that we help people in culturally appropriate ways, in ways that they find most important. And ultimately from us, from the healthcare field, it ensures that we are good stewards of our fiscal and other resources, but we also think it will ensure that the state become a good stewards of public resources. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this panel? Thank you very much. I want to acknowledge a group in the audience today. We have a group of preventive medicine residents from Oregon Health Sciences University with us. Looking at how health policy, maybe will you guys stand up? Thank you. Thank you for being here. We had a very interesting discussion this afternoon before the meeting on how much cultural competence is embedded in the medical education nowadays, and I had a pleasant surprise to hear it was embedded more than I thought. Representative Kenny Geyer asked for the last word on this topic before we leave.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I really just wrote a note saying I'll save my comments till Monday, but I will take the opportunity. I would love to say something else on Monday when we reopen this for a work session, but I'd like to thank you and also acknowledge the numerous letters that we've had in support of both of these issues. One was from the Commissions on Asian Pacific Affairs, African, Latino, women's groups, all of the advocacy commissions wrote a very strong letter of support in this. And absolutely, I feel as many of you have mentioned here that we have got to bring down the cost curve. It's vital for our public services. It's vital for our private businesses. It's vital for our families. And you know, we had a big discussion. Representative Conger mentioned the demand supply side. And so you've got, there's no one piece that's going to help us bring down the cost curve. But if this particular bill is aimed at giving tools to healthcare practitioners, and if we want patients to take more responsibility for their healthcare, which I agree is essential, that's the demand side and the supply side, we need to give practitioners those kinds of tools so that they can actually have a meaningful interaction with the patients about changing behaviors and lifestyles that might lead to adverse outcomes. There are a range of other things that Tricia mentioned in terms of public health, improving social determinants of health, having safe environments. There's a lot of things that fall outside that healthcare provider-patient relationship. But this is really aimed, I think, at that, and it's aimed at improving both sides of that piece. And you know, it's astounding to me to think that we don't, if you start from the premise of we don't, you know, we just look at bodies as human bodies and we're not thinking about behavior and culture as a way to try to affect that, it's kind of astounding that we would, you know, we should be questioning why wouldn't we have this. So I'm happy to open it next time with a few more comments, but I really want to thank everyone and acknowledge the enormous numbers of letters of support that we also got for both of these issues. So thank you.
We'll carry 2611 over and see where we're going. Can I have a brief moment with a couple of the advocates when we end here? I have appreciated the brevity of your comments, and I pushed on my colleagues and ignored some questions because we're under increasing pressure by the speaker to be out on time because we have another committee coming in right behind us. When many of you see the speaker, tell her we, for the record, we finished 1 minute early. We're adjourned.
It's okay for today because my